Hello and welcome to the final 2015 edition of the Bandwagon Podcast. I'm Brian Moline.
And I'm Lisa Braltz.
Where did the year go, Lisa?
Well, I don't know. I was just thinking this the other day that I can't believe it's already December, and it doesn't even feel like December, really. As we're recording this, it's probably still 50 degrees outside.
Yeah, 48. So yeah, anything but December-like weather. No snow on the ground, no nothing. It's just kind of a rainy, gray. It's more like late October.
Yeah, it's not looking good for Christmas either, I heard. I feel like we're not going to have any snow.
Mm. Well, that's good for travel, but it's not good for the aesthetics.
Oh, I feel like it depends on how you look at things. And the way I look at things is when you have more weather like this at the front of winter, that means winter overall will be shorter. Mm. And I'm okay with that.
Yeah, I can handle that.
I am okay with that. So, but we're not here to talk about the weather.
No, we're here to talk about sports on the Bandwagon Podcast. And we got a few interesting topics to dissect here today. And all the talk of winter makes me think of what is called the Baseball Hot Stove League and how maybe it's changed a little bit over the years. Of course, that term came around from, you know, guys sitting around in the off season, sitting around the stove at the barbershop or whatever, talking
right.
about what moves their team should make for the upcoming season during winter. And it's kind of evolved now where you've got the winter meetings that happen every year. This year they were in Nashville, Tennessee, and you got all the executives from baseball teams, agents, some players go down there, lots of media down there as well.
Mm-hmm.
And really where the baseball hot stove thing has just exploded is on social media these days.
Right. So, and that brings to mind a question that I have about this, because I know what it is. I've heard the term before, but when I first heard about the hot stove league, I didn't know it was called a league, but when I first heard about the hot stove, it was before the explosion of social media, where mm-hmm. it seemed like the person who introduced me to the concept was my former boss at a previous job. And he was very busy checking in this time of year, ESPN.com, maybe some other special websites. I'm sure mm-hmm. there are plenty of special websites devoted purely to this conversation. But there was no social media component really to it yet. This would have been in 2009, 2008, 2009, before things had really taken off on social media. So what was it like then versus now?
Well, it's kind of like you said, to really get this information, you really had to go seek it out a lot of times. I mean, you would have, like on sports talk radio stations, for instance, people talking about it. There would be a reporter from, say, The Score in Chicago covering the winter meetings, and so he would check in and say what he's hearing down at the winter meetings. And you could check in at ESPN or Fox Sports or whatever website of your choice to kind of see what rumors were being reported there. But right now, it's so instantaneous. Friday, for example, I got done working here at, I don't know, between 1 and 2 in the afternoon on mm-hmm. Friday and went home. And shortly after I got home, all of a sudden Twitter is exploding. The Cubs have signed Jason Hayward, biggest right. free agent on the market.
Even my Twitter was exploding with that information.
And I think that's the big difference, is that if you follow a number of people on Twitter, chances are that at least somebody in your that you follow was talking about that,
mm-hmm,
and it
mm-hmm.
was a big topic of conversation. So I think the biggest difference now is that information is really out there on social media to everybody, whereas before it was a little more focused, a little more specialized. If you wanted it, you could find it, but it wasn't as prevalent as it is now.
So I would say, you know, I mentioned that my former boss told me about what the hot stove was, and he was getting information from the internet. So have the winter meetings always been so important, even in the days before the internet? Like, was it just talk radio? I mean, how was it just newspaper reports? I mean, for me, it just seemed like baseball ended with the World Series, and then everybody was pumped for spring training. And now it seems like they've manufactured, it's like a fake Hallmark holiday or something. They've manufactured the season. So really, there is no off season for baseball.
Yeah, not as much. I think it's bigger than it used to be. I think really where the winter meetings started to become more important, I mean, in the past, even before free agency, you know, say pre-1976, which is when I think free agency came to Major League mm-hmm. Baseball, they would still get together for their winter meetings, and there would be some trades and things like that, but it wasn't nearly as active. You would not have, for instance, a caliber of player like Jason Hayward, for the most part, changing teams. That would be a rarity. Or a caliber player like a Zach Greinke, who signed a huge $200 million deal with the Arizona Diamondbacks. Players like that would very rarely change teams back in those days. But now, since free agency, that this time of year is when a lot of those contracts are agreed to. You'll have some of them that linger beyond the first of the year, and even some guys who don't sign until spring training is about ready to start. But I think the rise of social media and everything is, if anything, maybe kind of created that buzz. And I think even sometimes the teams kind of get caught up in it as well, you'll have teams saying, oh, well, my rival just made a big move. I have to make a big splash, too, so they don't get all the headlines.
Well, and the other thing that struck me from just doing some of the reading that I was doing about it before we came in to record, really, how is this different, or is it different than gossip? Like, everybody comes down hard on, like, Hollywood gossip and, oh, gossip terrible and, oh, going to these websites. But gossip is really just sort of idle speculation with maybe some kernels of truth and just completely nattering on and conversing with each other about things and getting all excited. Isn't this the same thing?
It pretty much basically is. Yeah, it basically is. I mean, you're talking about sports and guys changing teams and all that. You're not talking about player X, you know, you're not talking about somebody having an affair with somebody else or that kind of thing, but it's the same type of information.
But there's music industry or entertainment industry has to do with like who got kicked off of this film or who's directing this or whatever. I mean, this is sort of, I'm not talking about personal lives as much. There's plenty of sports gossip about those things too. This is sort of the equivalent though to sort of entertainment industry gossip in terms of how things get made.
Yeah.
More or less.
Yeah, I think they're pretty well equivalent, I'd say.
So, but sometimes I feel like when we're talking about the entertainment industry, people get really, like, they look down on that.
Mm.
And then for sports, though, it's kind of like this fun thing to talk about. And I'm like, it's all fun.
Yeah.
Right? It's all fun to sort of speculate and see how things are going to shake down. So when does the hot stove season end?
It pretty well will be over, I would say, about the time that pitchers and catchers start reporting.
So there is no offseason.
Yeah.
There's no offseason.
Yeah, I mean, it will diminish. We've had, I think, the biggest waves have been made already. But there will be there are a lot of other players out there who are free agents who have yet to sign for a team. A lot of times what happens is some of the bigger name guys, like Zach Greinke with Arizona and Jason Hayward with the Cubs, they sign first, and that kind of establishes the hierarchy.
Right.
Okay, this guy made this much. Well, this guy isn't quite as good a player, so we can't give him that money. But if Hayward got this much, then this guy will get this much. And you kind of get that hierarchy kind of set with the biggest name guys, and then everything else kind of falls into place.
Well, should be interesting, I guess. There's still some hot stove season to go.
There is. My Cubs are looking good. Obviously, that's been said many times in the past, but I feel good about 2016.
I love the eternal optimism. It's sort of like gardening. You know, if something fails, you've got next year. You can just try it again, right?
So that's right.
Anyway, so you mentioned Jason Hayward, which got me thinking of Justin Hayward. Do you know who Justin Hayward is?
I do not.
Justin Hayward is the singer and one of the primary songwriters and one of the original members of the band The Moody Blues.
Oh, sure.
And actually, I thought you said Justin Hayward for a second. I was like, wait, is that really his name? So, but anyway, so that can kind of bring us, midwife us gently into our next segment, which I wanted to talk about the relationship between what I call rock and jock.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to talk about my experience. I wanted to unload on you guys about my experience growing up in suburban Minneapolis as a person who really enjoyed punk rock music in the 80s, but also played sports, and how many of my classmates, teammates, and punk rock friends had no idea what to do with me because punk rockers hated jocks and jocks picked on punk rockers. But somehow I had a foot in both worlds. And I think that's probably an experience that a lot of people had. You and I talked a little bit about that. But my favorite thing to talk, my favorite story, or one of my favorite stories to talk about, is how in high school I was totally vilified. Remember, this is the early 80s for liking the band U2. Like, it wasn't Journey. It wasn't Foreigner. It wasn't Styx. It wasn't anything that anybody knew.
So this is kind of probably around the era of their October album.
October, Into War,
okay.
Into Unforgettable Fire. So that period of the early to segueing into the mid-80s. And MTV was around, but not everybody watched it the way I did. Like, when I discovered that, I was like, oh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
These are my people. You know, bands like The Cure and so much of early MTV, Kate Bush, the stuff that they... a few years later weren't even showing anymore. And early U2 videos too, they showed a lot of those. Anyway, I was just made fun of constantly, for liking U2 by the sports people that I hung out with. I played basketball and a few other sports. And 2 years later, those same people were sleeping out for tickets on the
Joshua Tree
tour.
Yeah, that's when
they
went mainstream.
Back when you could sleep out, back when you slept out for tickets and it wasn't all done online, you would like camp out in front of the box office for 2 days or whatever. So I always thought that was interesting. I think the relationship between music and sports, there's much more crossover now, I think. Mm-hmm. And I think probably even in high school as well. I'm trying to figure out why certain types of music were so looked down upon in both directions. You know, only the jocks like crappy music. I mean, I like Journey, you know, but, so what was your experience? Did you have any similar experiences?
My experience was a little bit different. I wouldn't necessarily say I was, you know, in the punk rock crowd when I was in high school. I was a person who had my foot in like four or five different crowds. I had one foot in the jock crowd. I played three sports in high school: football, basketball. I ran track. I was in the band crowd. I was in the drama crowd.
Like the marching
crowd.
Band crowd?
Well.
Or just the jazz band crowd or all the bands?
All the bands, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
And so my school was big enough to have all those things, but not too big where you kind of got pushed in one direction, so to speak. I feel like now it seems like you kind of get pushed in one direction pretty early, whether you're a music person or a sports person. It's a little tougher to maybe have your foot in both. So I guess my experience there was I was probably more friends with some of the nerds, so to speak, some of the high achieving academic guys that we were on mock trial together
oh,
in high school.
Awesome.
Yeah, man.
Is there video evidence of this?
I do not believe so, thank goodness.
Not that you'd tell me if there was.
No, I don't think there was, thank goodness, but... But that, yeah, my experience was a little bit different than yours. I wasn't necessarily in the punk rock crowd, although I think by the time I was getting toward the end of high school, some of my, you know, quote, nerd friends had kind of started gravitating that direction.
Mm-hmm.
This was the early 90s. So they had gotten into Red Hot Chili Peppers kind of just before they went mainstream with Blood Sugar Sex Magik was their first album that really hit it big.
Mm-hmm.
And then bands like Ministry, Primus... was another one.
Oh, yeah.
Early
Primus.
90s. Yeah. So some
They're
of the,
still around.
Yeah. Yeah. So, there was a little bit of that, but I felt like I didn't have kind of both feet in that camp. You know, I listened to some of those bands and I enjoyed some of those bands, but it wasn't my thing necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly wasn't really a part of the jock crowd. I was just kind of all over the place.
Nobody knew what to do with me. And I have to mention that like liking U2 is not what they're not a punk band. They never were. I mean, maybe very early when they started, they were very influenced by punk, but I liked a lot of other bands too that like no one had ever heard of. We had in Minneapolis, it's still going, community radio station called KFAI. That I happened upon one night, just twirling the dial, doing my homework. And I could have ended up at KQRS, which was the classic rock station. Well, it wasn't called classic rock then, but
it was just rock.
That's what they were doing. I mean, that it was all Stones and stuff like that. But then before I could get to KQ, which is what everybody called it, I happened upon a like 90.5, I can't remember exactly what their numbers were, KFAI, which was a community station that I could not. It was the first time I had ever been able to get it. I didn't even know what I was listening to. And that really sort of shaped my interest in music outside of like even the alternative mainstream sort of. So, but back then in the early 80s, I mean, if it wasn't on KQ, if you were listening to stuff that wasn't on KQ, people were sort of like, oh,
it was that's a lot, different. It was a lot harder to, I think, have those musical interests, especially depending on where you were. Like for me, growing up in Northeast Iowa, I don't even know where I would have heard most of those bands like you're talking about, because there were pretty much, there was mainstream radio. I didn't have cable, so I didn't even have MTV until I got into high school.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, I listened to what was on the radio when I was a kid. That's what I did because I didn't really know really anything else outside of that.
Well, and I was very fortunate to grow up in suburban Minneapolis where there was just like this super potent punk rock scene. We also had Prince.
Mm-hmm.
Prince lived like 10 minutes away from my house, and his bodyguard's daughters went to my high school. So there was kind of this really interesting Prince thread that was also going through my high school, and mm-hmm. and it was interesting. So you had all this classic rock, but then you had this really, I mean, until Purple Rain, Prince was largely a pretty underground, a little more transgressive type artist. I mean, mm-hmm. so, and then he had all these offshoot bands that it was pretty unusual for a bunch of high school kids to really be into that stuff, but they were. So I'm not dissing my high school experience at all. I just thought it was really interesting that it definitely seemed to be like this wariness of like, oh, I play basketball and I'm not really sure about your music, or I go to punk shows and I'm not really sure about sports.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of those barriers have kind of been, if not completely knocked down, at least diminished. Like, yeah, you and I were talking, Jack McDowell, who pitched for the White Sox.
Exactly.
Was in a band.
He was in two bands. I did some research. So when I lived in Chicago in the early 90s, he was in a band called View, mm-hmm. V-I-E-W, like that it was separated by periods, each letter. And they opened for the band The Smithereens several times. I think they did a tour with them. And then he was in a band after he retired called Stick Figure. I haven't been able to really figure out exactly what it is he's doing now. But yeah, he was definitely, you'd see him at shows and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think there are, you'll see that. Like, it's interesting. The guy who's the play-by-play announcer for the Chicago Cubs on TV now, Len Casper, he's probably about once a week he'll be talking about a band he saw or a show he went to mm-hmm. in Chicago. And just, it does seem like a lot of those, I don't know, taboos for the crossover between rock and jock are just not nearly as prevalent as they used to be.
I would agree. And so I did a little research and found that in 2013, ESPN did a series of album covers recreated by athletes.
Oh, wow.
So you had somebody, I can't remember who the athlete was, recreating the cover of Thriller by Michael Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
Alex Morgan from the U.S. Women's National Team and Portland, I believe. Did she get traded? I can't remember. But Alex Morgan, you know, A-Morg, mm-hmm. Recreating a Katy Perry album cover. And so, and there are many, many more. And we'll post a link to that so you can see all these beautiful recreations. I think there's definitely more of a like, music is cool. And it's cool. It's cool to, I could go on for hours about how I think musical events in the early 90s really sort of were the catalyst for this kind of change, bringing alternative to the mainstream and bringing music more.
Lollapalooza.
Exactly. The festival culture and things like that. But that's another potential podcast maybe. But I'm also interested in musicians who are obsessed with sports.
Mm.
So you have musicians, so you have sports people who are trying to be musicians. And that, but like, and they might be able to put out a CD. I mean, almost anybody can put out a CD. But can a music person like become a professional athlete? No.
I just remember
being at Lollapalooza in 1994 when the Smashing Pumpkins were one of the headliners, and I was backstage watching like Billy Corgan and the Beastie Boys all play basketball together, and they were terrible. but they were so into it, and Billy Corgan in particular has been a big champion of sports, professional wrestling, Chicago sports. I mean, he like I think he if he couldn't play guitar, he would have desperately wanted to play basketball.
Yeah.
And so and I'm sure there are many, many other athletes. I mean, I know that Shaquille O'Neal and Kobe Bryant have released records. I've discovered, and then we talked about Jack McDowell, Nick Swisher.
Okay. Yeah.
Released a kids music record. But, you know, I'm thinking of these musicians trying to make the transition into sports, and I'm just not sure it could ever happen.
Yeah. I think one of the more successful ones, and now that I'm thinking about it, that went from sports to music is Bernie Williams, who is an outfielder for the New York Yankees. Mm. He's actually, I think, been at least a decently successful fusion jazz guitarist.
Okay, interesting.
I think he actually maybe released his first album while he was still playing, and he's released a few others since he retired.
It's just you're not going to see it equally both ways. I mean, no. I think you're going to have more athletes trying to be musicians and maybe seeing some success than the other way around.
Yeah.
Unless it's in their Park District League or something, or backstage at Lollapalooza.
Yeah, so, there you go. Yeah, do you know, did Billy win his game against the Beastie Boys?
Oh, well, he was a lot taller than they were, but kind of clumsy.
Gotcha.
So.
All right, good to know. Let's see, a couple of other articles just caught our eye and wanted to share with you. One of them, the one that I sent along this morning to Lisa, was the fact that Serena Williams was just named the Sports Illustrated Sportsperson of the Year, which I think is really awesome. I mean, she's been just dominating women's tennis for mm-hmm. how many years now?
Oh, it seems like forever.
She's, I think, 34 now, which mm-hmm. is, that's pretty old for a professional tennis player these days. Most of the time, you know, they get to their early 30s, they're kind of on the downside.
When did she start her pro career? Do you remember?
Oh,
was she 14 or 15?
Something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, she was in her teens for sure.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And she was kind of, she came along after Venus, who kind of took the tennis world by storm when she came along, and Serena was the younger sister, but it didn't take too long for Serena to pass up Big Sis. And, you know, this past year I was reading S.L. Price's article about Serena and just some of the challenges she had. You really didn't think about it too much because she won 3 Grand Slams. She had a great year, but she was battling a lot of injuries mm-hmm. and illness mm-hmm. and everything else. It was certainly not an easy year for her, but
no.
She just pushed through it and you know, had one of, if not the best season of her career.
Yeah, and even, and the author points out that even though she had all these crazy bad things happen to her, especially around her health and her knees and mm-hmm. other things, she was also untouchable in some of the things that she did outside of sports, too, in terms of being in a really bad movie. And
yeah.
Nobody cared, and it made a lot of money, and nobody gave her a hard time about it, you know. So I think she has laid some pretty awesome groundwork for her post tennis career.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think a lot every time there's a tennis grand slam, they always do some sort of mini documentary about the Williams sisters and how they came up into tennis, and how, you know, you see the old footage of them, the two, Venus and Serena, mm-hmm. together playing tennis and playing against each other. And it's just always a thing. So much of that life has been settled for them. So I'm excited to see them both moving past mm-hmm. In Serena's case in particular, being at the top of her game, although Venus had a pretty decent year
yeah.
last year as well.
Yeah.
And she's a couple years older, I think,
right.
too.
Yeah, she is.
And she has an autoimmune disorder, so she's battling, you know, a lot of different things as well. It's really nice to see them laying the groundwork for their post-tennis careers, and they're both pretty savvy business persons, and yeah, I think she's an excellent choice.
Yeah, I totally agree. Another one that you pointed out, and I read through these quickly this morning, but I'll let you talk about the article Patrick O'Sullivan wrote. He's retired NHL player, drafted by Minnesota, recently retired. Just a very, I don't know how to describe it other than to say startling article he wrote about the abuse he faced growing up.
Yes. He starts off, the first line of the story, the first paragraph is, "My father used to beat the beep out of me."
Mm-hmm.
And so, and then next paragraph, so there's this nice long visual pause. So when you're reading the article, you're just kind of like, wow. I ran across this article. My friend Todd posted this on Facebook over the weekend. He's a hockey parent
mm-hmm.
Who is very much about promoting kids having fun, parents not being jerks. You know, parents aren't the coaches. Parents need to sort of, you know, let the kids play. So I read a lot of the stuff that he posts, and this actually just like made my stomach hurt reading it. This goes beyond having a parent yell at you for having a bad game or making you go practice when you don't want to mm-hmm. practice. This was a young man who was so dedicated to his sport and played and was an exceptional talent, whose father beat the beep out of him every day.
Yeah.
Every day.
Yeah, and it was basically he was hoping, his hope every night was that it would be a normal night, which meant that
yes. Oh,
that you know his father would hit him for a while and then stop, and it wouldn't be anything beyond that. And there were plenty of nights where it went well beyond that. It just reading that beginning to end. Just highly recommended. He wrote that for the Players Tribune. When we'll link to this in our podcast here a little bit later this morning. But it's at theplayerstribune.com, and unbelievable.
It's a really powerful story, and it makes you realize that when people don't like to talk about it and they don't want to get involved in other people's business, but this kid was like, and he said something really striking at the end. I just interrupted myself, but he said that the reason why he got so good is because he spent the time away from home to get away from his dad. He spent with like a hockey stick and a tennis ball.
Yeah. Yeah.
Practicing his stick work and all of that. And so in some weird way, it was a positive.
Yeah.
I, as a soccer parent, the Illinois Football Club IFC here locally in town, they have a Sunday or two every season where parents can't make any noise at all.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Like it's Silent Sunday or something where it's just the coaches can holler instructions at their players and the parents can't holler encouragement or abuse.
Wow.
So it's pretty interesting. But yeah, it does make me wonder sometimes about what we don't see as parents. Pretty powerful.
Yeah, and the other one you shared, which was also very powerful in a different way, was an article about the 1968 Olympics. I think most people remember John Carlos and Tommy Smith, their gesture of raising their fist to protest what was happening back in the United States. But this is about the other man on that podium, an Australian sprinter named Peter Norman. And I don't think... I certainly didn't. I just kind of saw him, he's the other guy. He won the silver. But he went through a lot of stuff himself back in Australia after those Olympics. And this article by Jing Chen, I believe it's from the San Francisco Chronicle, San Francisco Globe, excuse me. It's very powerful in its own way, detailing the things that Peter Norman went through because he refused to disassociate himself with John Carlos and Tommy Smith.
And I think everybody's familiar with it. Well, not everybody, but most people are familiar with that photograph. Mm-hmm. And he's on the podium just staring straight ahead. And people can think whatever they think about that, or they think they know something by looking at that, like, oh, look at that guy. He's just staring straight ahead and... you know, he probably just wishes this moment was over or whatever. People are very quick to, you know, attribute certain things to people. When reading this article and actually finding out what had gone on up until that moment and then everything that happened after, again, super powerful. This article includes a photo of a sculpture that has the second place area on the podium is empty. Mm-hmm. And it's easy to look at that picture and go, oh, they left him off because he's not important. But actually, he said that he wanted that to be empty so that anybody could step onto that podium and be part of that.
Wow.
And part of that picture. So, yeah, really great article. I'm not exactly sure how I found that one. Probably Twitter or something. But,
yeah,
really good stuff. Some stuff to read over the holidays.
Yeah, that's right, because it is that time. And you can watch one of the 40 bowl games.
Oh, God.
That are going on.
Yeah, we didn't get a chance to talk much about that. But I wonder if part of the reason there are so many bowl games now is because, I mean, now you have like the playoff system. And so you have your New Year's Day bowls, your really important ones. And then there's all these mini bowl. I mean, I guess I don't get it. Like everybody gets a bowl game, like everybody gets a trophy.
Yeah, it's something like that. Although I'll tell you this, they wouldn't have the bowl games if they weren't making money in some way, shape or form.
No, that's true. But I don't know.
Yeah,
so, I'm probably not going to watch any of them, so sorry.
Well, I'll watch some of them.
I'll follow along on Twitter. That's how I watch some sports sometimes.
I'll definitely watch some of them as well. So, yeah, that'll keep you busy until the next edition of The Bandwagon.
So I guess we'll wrap it up.
Oh, we will.
So thank you so much for joining us today on The Bandwagon, where, as we like to remind you, there's plenty of room for everyone. Bandwagon is produced by us, Lisa Braltz and Brian Moline. Brian does a bunch of the heavy lifting, too. He's the studio engineer and the editor. Scott Cameron is WILL's Director of News and Public Affairs. Many thanks to him and the WILL Newsroom for their support and tolerance. Our theme song is by those kooks from Athens, G-A-R-E-M, another band that nobody understood why I liked them in high school. You can locate past episodes of The Bandwagon at will.illinois.edu, as well as links to the articles we discussed and some basic show notes. We'd love your feedback via email, or if you would prefer to start the conversation online, go ahead and ping us at
BMOLE, W-I-L-L.
And Lisa, or at Lisa Braltz. This is the last episode of The Bandwagon for 2015. We'll be back in the saddle, so to speak, of The Bandwagon. That doesn't make any sense. The week of January 18th, 2016. Thank you for listening, and see you next year.
Happy New Year.